not till we're more than a quarter of the way through the purgatory. Up to that time, we have various sections of what's sometimes called anti-purgatory, a place where those who kept God waiting are themselves waiting for the purgation process to begin. So we don't just leap onto these seven terraces of the mountain, but rather we have a number of very important encounters before we actually get to the gate before which through which they must pass in order to get to the actual seven terraces. And in Canto 3, Dante meets up with another figure we probably wouldn't expect to find here. He meets up with a guy named Manfred. Manfred turns out to be the son of the Emperor Frederick II. He's the one who carried on Frederick II's military and political ambitions, therefore sort of the great boohoo of the Ghibelline world, after Frederick dies in 1250. He's a Ghibelline. He's a pretty violent guy. And in those struggles with the papacy, he was excommunicated. He was killed in 1266 at the Battle of Benevento, a battle that in fact led directly to the Guelph return in Florence, something that was good for Dante, given the fact that he was 1 year old and his family was Guelph. Nevertheless, we meet up with Manfred, who tells us an extraordinary story about the last minutes of his life.
First thing he does is ask Dante if he recognizes him. Now, Manfred was a pretty famous guy, but Dante doesn't. And it's sort of interesting. It doesn't throw him into a fit as it would have, let's say, for a character like Farinata in Hell, or in fact any of them who were sort of obsessed with their own name and their own fame. Here's this guy who was very famous then. There's a kind of obscurity now, and it, again, to pick it up in the text, when I, Dante the Pilgrim speaking, in all humility confessed I did not recognize him, he said, "Look," as he revealed a gash above his breast. Then with a smile he said, "Manfred I am, grandson of Empress Constance, and I beg you, when you are with the living once again, to go to my lovely child, mother of kings who honor Sicily and Aragon, whatever may be rumored, tell her this." And then he tells the story of his own death. Now, the first thing that I think is kind of interesting is the question of why is this man smiling? What is there about his situation that would warrant a smile? Our take on this is that it's an awareness on Manfred's part, the sort of "bet I'm the last guy that you expected to see here among the saved. Bet you thought that I'd be back down there," and sort of happy about the situation, but also not boasting about who he is in any way. Perfectly happy to just say, "You know, here I am, I'm Manfred, let me tell you my story." Not because the story paints him in a particularly, attractive light, but rather because what the story does is say something about the mercy of God, which is what the rest of it is really all about.
As I lay there, dying on the battlefield of Benevento, my body torn by these two mortal wounds, weeping, I gave my soul to him who grants forgiveness willingly. This was a last-minute choice. Horrible was the nature of my sins, but boundless mercy stretches out his arms to any man who comes in search of it. I was a pretty bad guy, he says, and I'm lying here dying on this battlefield, and I sincerely, honestly turn to God. And that's all it takes. That's all it takes. It doesn't take the completion of that process. It doesn't take years of bread and water. It takes a word. It takes a gesture. Even if life is escaping you at the moment, this is not, however, about him. It's about the mercy of God. In a sense that this is like all choices, God is ultimately the guide. God offers us this opportunity. I took it.
Notice also he says something here which might seem at first to be a little bit shocking, because remember, he's somebody who has been, as Bill said, excommunicated for what he does. Well, what does excommunication mean? He tells us what it doesn't mean. Again, Manfred still speaking. "The church's curse is not the final word, for everlasting love may still return if hope reveals the slightest hint of green." Excommunication is not the church disposing of your soul in the afterlife. It can't do it. It doesn't have the power to do that, and that's not what it's meant to do. So even though that excommunication is sort of responsible for Manfred spending a good bit of time here, it has nothing to do with the final disposition of his soul afterwards. And that's another important point that Dante wants to make.
So now in the lectures that follow, we're going to begin that journey. It's a struggle at first. It gets easier as we go on toward the gate and then up the seven-story mountain.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at teachco.com. Or you can call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you. These lectures are part of the Great Courses. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The lectures on these tapes are titled Dante's Divine Comedy, Part 2. Lecture 13, Purgatory's Waiting Room.
In this lecture, we're going to spend a little bit more time in the place called Ante-Purgatory. As we've already mentioned, until we go through the actual gate of purgatory in Canto 9, and see the actual purgation process begin, we're in kind of a holding pattern. But it's worthwhile, I think, to spend at least a little bit more time there, and for a couple of reasons. First of all, the souls that we meet there turn out to be very interesting. Secondly, they tell us a lot about the territory, about the nature of purgatory as a whole, a place where mercy is the operative word. But there are a couple of other things that are also very interesting about the souls that we meet here. One of them is that there's a way in which they look back at stuff that has already happened in the Inferno. And it sort of is our first way of fulfilling a promise that we made at the very beginning of these lectures, namely that Inferno was really only the first offer, and that issues and subjects that come up there really can't be seen as entirely complete until we see how they're taken up in the other parts of the afterlife. And so some of the examples that we see here in Ante-Purgatorio turn out to be those that have a really interesting relationship with sinners that we saw back there in hell. And that seems to be true of the people that we'll be spending time on today. We'll also be saying some more about the way in which purgatory is put together in this lecture.
One of the things that Ron just pointed out is that we aren't yet to the place where the purgation per se starts. Nevertheless, there are certain patterns that begin in the Ante-Purgatory that are going to continue all the way through this part of Dante's afterlife. And I would like to suggest one. At the beginning of Canto 5, and not for the first time, the sinners who were there to repent sing, and they sing a psalm. In fact, the first words of the psalm are usually given by Dante in Latin because, of course, that was the language that the church used. And that reminds us that there's, in fact, a great deal of ritual throughout the purgatory, including but not limited to singing. And we might ask why that is. Seems to me a couple things are important to say. First of all, what Dante is largely going to do is use the structure of the monastic day. Dante would have been much more familiar with monasteries, simply being a citizen of any part of Europe in the Middle Ages, than most people, even Catholics, are today. There was a monastery in the middle of Florence. There was a monastery in the hill overlooking Florence. And monasteries, by and large, served as the hotels of Europe in the Middle Ages. So as Dante traveled, he would have been in a lot of monasteries. And they regulated and controlled their whole day by getting together 8 times a day, once at night, 7 times during the daylight hours, to pray communally. Of course, they also prayed individually. And that their hymn book for those sessions of prayer, called monastic offices, was in fact the Book of Psalms. So that there's going to be a great deal of ritual, especially ritual singing, and that's going to suggest something of the structure of the monastic day. Why is it important to say this about purgatory. First of all, it's vital to realize that what Dante wants to do is show how there's something going on back on earth that also relates to that purgation process. That is to say, we can back on earth, in our churches, visiting a monastery, even in our own homes, we can do something of that orderliness, that pattern, that repetition that is so important. The monks sing all the psalm book every week, and some psalms they sing every day. And that puts you in a kind of practice, a kind of discipline. Also, since many of the psalms, including the one here in Canto 5 of Purgatory, are specifically about doing penance, they provide a kind of structure to living a life of penitence. Because as Ron and I have already said a gazillion times, and we'll say a few more times, the difference between the sinners in hell and those people in heaven is not that one group sinned and the other didn't. It's that those who are in heaven repented.
I want to just piggyback on what Bill said with a couple of observations. One, this also fits in very nicely with one of the major points that we made earlier about purgatory, namely that repentance is a communal activity, and the souls here have to learn how to act communally. Well, the monastic office would have been that great example of a kind of communal service back on earth. So Dante has taken it and incorporated it here into the Purgatorio. The other thing is that the whole idea of ritual, which is, I think, a harder sell in our time than it would have been in Dante's, has a whole lot to do with a kind of transformation where you start with something that is material and move to the spiritual, basically by taking something that sort of external and imposed on you and somehow making it internal. And that process of going from external to internal really turns out to be what the Purgatorio as a whole is all about. And so again, what Bill said here really turns out to be one of the very important guides, really, that we need to take with us at everything that we see, or for everything that we see in the Purgatorio.
We want to introduce you to some of the folks that Dante meets before he gets to the gate of Purgatory proper. And today we'd like to begin with a fellow named Buonconte da Montefeltro, not exactly a name that trips off the tongue. But he turns out to be an important character for a couple reasons. First of all, like so many we met back in hell, he's involved in the Guelph-Ghibelline struggle. In fact, he was killed in a battle between Guelph Florence and Ghibelline Arezzo. And he was a Ghibelline, and they were the losers in that battle, and he dies on the battlefield. So we begin to see some of a similar cast of characters to folks we met back in hell, but of course, character with a big difference. Buonconte explains to us that he repented at the last minute. In fact, really at the last second. He said one word as he was dying, a sincere word we are meant to understand, and that's all it takes.
So we've already seen previously souls who kind of made it in by the skin of their teeth because they had been excommunicated, souls who had been slothful. Now we find another one of those interesting test cases, somebody who waits till the very, very last second of his life and repents in a way that we are meant to be seen, we are meant to see as absolutely sincere. But there's one other thing about Buonconte that makes him particularly worth dwelling on, and that is that he is the son of Guido de Montefeltro, whom we had spent some time on back in Inferno, Inferno 27, if you'll remember, when we were talking about the false counselors. And remember, in talking about Papa Guido, what we talked about was somebody who tried, quote-unquote, repentance. It really turned out to be a sort of false repentance, this attempt to scam God, and then at the last minute, if you will, is lured back into his evil life by Pope Boniface VIII, so that we have this sort of family situation where the son sort of echoes the father's career in some ways, but with altogether different results in the afterlife. So that this is a kind of nifty way, going from the infernal family member to the purgatorial family member, of seeing something about the way in which repentance actually works.
And Dante carries this further for us to draw this connection between dad and son, because at the end of Inferno 27, we have the story of St. Francis. Remember, Guido was a Franciscan, to come down and take the soul of his brother up to heaven. But the devil comes and says, sorry, This one's mine. You can't have him. And of course, it's the devil that takes away Guido's soul. Well, Dante sets up an interesting parallel here in Purgatory 5. Okay? God's angel took me up, and hell's fiend cried, O you from heaven, why steal what is mine? This is, of course, the same kind of scenario, but a different winner. In this case, the difference is that one word of repentance, and now the angel takes the soul, and the devil goes off having lost. So that Dante is very much trying to show his readers, you can't just pay attention to stories in and of themselves. You've got to think back to what you know. And of course, the further we read, the more we'll have to think back on it. Something we'll be doing many, many times between now and the end of the Paradiso.
And of course, also notice that this is also to make an obvious point that you don't get your place in the afterlife by your family connection. This is another example where we see families split with one member in hell and somebody else who has been saved. We saw that, you'll recall, with Manfred and with Frederick II previously. It's also interesting that he saved. The devils are angry at all of this, or the particular devil who comes down to grab his soul. And so what that devil decides to do is mess around with Buonconte's body and essentially make sure that it has this really nasty end and, you know, does all kinds of abusive things to it. But it doesn't really matter at this point. And this is another way of calling our attention to the fact that purgatory is a place where we sort of try and figure out what bodies are good for and what their limitations are and what their presence in the afterlife, or at least virtual presence, we have a modern word that works very well, of bodies in the afterlife might signify. Purgatory deals with this, again, as Bill and I have mentioned, as the part of the afterlife which is most like life back on earth.
And right at the end of Canto 5, another character comes off for a very brief stay, very brief chat with Dante. She sort of says to him, will you remember me back on earth? And then she identifies herself as a woman named Pia. And she speaks this great line. Siena gave me life. Maremma, death. I was born in Siena. I died in this sort of woodsy area to the west of Siena. In Italian, it's one of the most beautiful lines in the entire poem. Siena mi fe, disfece mi Maremma. Siena made me, and then the Maremma unmade me. The line works beautifully. But the story is interesting because, as it turns out, she is a woman who, at least according to the traditions, was caught in adultery. And her husband killed her. Does this remind us of anyone who was caught in adultery and her husband killed her? We're in Purgatory 5. And, of course, it was the story of Francesca in Inferno 5, a story that went on and on and on with her conversation that set up this scenario. Now we have the same story, different ending.
And of course, once you begin thinking about this in terms of Francesca, then a number of things that are present here become more interesting, more resonant, more important. One of them, the very brevity itself. All right, Francesca, the first sinner that we see in Inferno, who has kind of a long spiel, is somebody who is nothing if not self-serving and goes on and on in this kind of overly romanticized way, as we talked about in some detail. Well, the very brevity here is a nifty contrast to that, that she's not interested in that kind of self-serving. She's interested in being remembered. But she says this in an extraordinarily succinct sort of way and doesn't do a whole lot to call attention to herself. So, again, the difference between what got her to salvation and what keeps Francesca down in Inferno has to do with repentance. But how do you embody that? How do you show that? What you see when Francesca talks is Francesca keeps recreating the very thing that got her there. And here you have this sort of quiet move away from the self, and we see all the difference between them. Now, it's also interesting that if Canto 5 of the Inferno and Canto 5 of the Purgatorio are linked this way by the figure of Francesca and the figure of Pia, when we get to Canto 6, we have another one of those very interesting linkages. Canto 6 of the Inferno was the first place where Dante began to sort of speak seriously about Florentine party politics and the notion that it was sort of politics that got him in trouble is also brought up for the first time there, because that's the very first place where there is some kind of prediction, sort of hazy prediction of his exile. When we move to Purgatorio 6, it turns out that the subject matter, politics, stays the same, but we sort of widen the canvas a little bit in one of the more interesting encounters between Dante and a figure in Anti-Purgatorio.
We meet a fellow named Sordello, a poet from the city of Mantua in the north, which, as we'll see in a minute, very importantly, turns out also to be Virgil's hometown. And therefore, what we want to do is take a look at the meeting of Sordello with Dante and Virgil to contrast it partly, as Ron already suggested, with what happens in Inferno 6 in our discussion of politics, but also to contrast it with Inferno 10. Because if you recall, two fellow Florentines met up in Inferno 10, Dante and Farinata, and they immediately began dividing. They immediately began talking about what separated them. Look here at this meeting. This fellow tells us that, well, let me read you. O Mantuan, I am Sordello of your town, and the two shades embraced. As soon as Sordello hears the word Mantua, referring to Virgil, doesn't know who Virgil is, says, you're my fellow Mantuan, let's hug. So it's a radically different first move. And again, it reminds us that this is a very different sort of place than the place that's so concerned with factional politics, getting a leg up, as we saw both in Inferno 6 and Inferno 10.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Bill brought up the connection with Farinata. Remember, it was the identification as a fellow Tuscan that allowed Farinata to begin dumping on Dante and talking about his family and his ancestors and his party as being better than Dante's. So here, what you have is this sort of recognized kinship is the opportunity for an embrace. That parallel with Farinata is also brought out in another interesting way. When they see Sordello, okay, as they're sort of approaching, he's sort of described as, well, O Lombard soul, how stately and disdainful you appeared, what majesty was in your steady gaze. Well, again, that has a lot to do with the way in which Farinata was introduced back in Inferno 10, a kind of stateliness and majesty. But of course, it turns out in Farinata's case that that's sort of the prelude to this giant economy-sized pride, really, this monstrous pride. And here, this sort of stately pose immediately gives way to something else where he and Virgil embrace. Now remember, all he knows is that this is a fellow Mantuan citizen. There's no sense here that he's embracing the most famous Mantuan citizen. He doesn't know that this is Virgil. That surprise waits for a little bit later. But, in fact, what's really nifty is that just watching this, that is to say, Dante is sort of observing the embrace between Sordello and Virgil, and that allows him to kind of let it all out in terms of an invective against this terrible partisan disease, this partisan politics stuff that has been running rampant throughout Italy in his time, and begins to speak about politics, not just in Florence, but in all of Italy, so that just as Inferno 6 deals with local Florentine politics, here in Purgatorio 6, we deal with sort of Italian, the whole geography, the whole peninsula, the politics of Italy.
And what's important is, as just as Ron said, in fact, the two Mantuans don't talk about Mantua. For one thing, that would sort of leave Dante, the third person in this group, out. They immediately talk about Italy, which of course means that they're all included because two may be from Mantua and one from Florence, but they're all Italians. And they begin to deal with some of the issues that are in Italy in Dante's own day. Why is Italy so divided? After all, in the last canto, we just saw somebody who died on a battlefield, fought between Arezzo and Florence. Why is this going on all the time? And here is at least an answer. What matter if Justinian repaired the bridle if the saddle's empty now? The shame would have been less if he had not. In other words, we have law because Justinian took all of Roman law many centuries before and codified it. So we have the great gift of Romans. We have Roman law. But there's nobody to exercise that Roman law because the Holy Roman Emperor, or what we might call just even the Roman Emperor, is in fact off in Germany and paying no attention to Italy at all. And so Italy is left without a ruler. How embarrassing, given the fact Italy has law, but nobody to enforce it, nobody to carry it out. And we have to ask, why is this? Well, actually, there are a couple folks to blame. One is the Holy Roman Emperor. The other is the Pope, because it is the Pope's interest to keep the emperors out of Italy, out of Italian politics. We've talked about that whole Guelph-Ghibelline struggle. And so what we've got is this sort of twin blame placed on the emperor, who's not doing his job in Italy, and the Pope, who's trying to keep the emperor from doing his job in Italy, and therefore would like to do the emperor's job in Italy, something for which the Pope is not at all equipped.
I wonder if it's okay in here to sort of throw a plug in, a kind of preview of coming attractions. We saw that Justinian is the great lawgiver, and it's sort of interesting that when we get to Paradiso 6, a place that we're actually going to stop at for quite a while, the only speaker in that entire canto turns out to be the very Justinian who is mentioned here. So, again, as a kind of preview, a linkage between Inferno 6, Purgatorio 6, goes all the way up to Paradiso 6. Another thing that's really nifty in this sort of discussion of what all of the bad things are that take place because of this factionalism is a description that Dante gives of it. He says, "Come and see the Capoletti, callous heart, see the Minaldi, the Montecchi ruined, the Filippeschi fearful of their fate." These are, of course, noble Italian families. If you were doing a more complete English translation of Capoletti and Montecchi, you would get Capulets and Montagues. So that what he's talking about is the very feud that sort of powers Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet a few centuries later. So that this whole idea of feuding that we've seen right from the beginning, from the beginnings of our discussion in Paradiso. Now is the subject for this fierce, fierce invective on the part of Dante.
And Dante, at the end of this canto, takes up another issue, another way in which Italy, and in this case Florence in particular, is victim to all this partisan bickering. And that is, he says that by the time November is half done, the laws spun in October are in shreds. How often within memory have you changed coinage and customs, law and offices, and members of your body politic? One of the things that goes all the way back to the ideas of some of the Greek philosophers is if you're going to have laws and laws that get respect, they've got to stay laws for a while. You can't keep changing laws all the time. Well, of course, what happens is that you get a new faction taking over, whether it's Guelphs or Ghibellines or white Guelphs or black Guelphs, and they come in, they change offices, but they also change constitutions, we would say. They configure the offices differently. They assign different amounts of time to them. They have different members and different numbers of members of various boards and so on. And so there's this chaos. How do you live in a society where tomorrow the laws might change? What you're doing today may be prohibited tomorrow. This is one of the problems of factionalism, all the unsteadiness, all the confusion that goes with it. And unlike our American Constitution, they didn't have ex post facto laws. You can't condemn people in our country for things that were done before a particular law made it illegal. But we don't have that in Florence. And can you imagine the confusion, the timidity that you must have to take any kind of action if you don't know what the laws that you're going to be subject to are tomorrow?
The invective ends with this extraordinary denunciation of Florence. Think back, and if you see the truth, you'll see that you, Italy itself, are like a woman very sick who finds no rest on her soft, sumptuous bed and turns and tosses to escape her pain. Wow. Now, notice that all of this is Dante sort of going a little berserk about this problem of factionalism. One thing to say about it is that it shows he certainly learned a lot since his encounter with Farinata back on Inferno 10. But what's sort of interesting is that it just kind of all, you know, bubbles out here, and it interrupts the fact that the last thing we saw was sort of Sordello and Virgil embracing each other. Sordello was embracing Virgil simply because he was a fellow Mantuan, this citizen embracing another citizen. But then he says, you know, he sort of listens to Dante giving this incredible harangue, and he says, wait a minute, who are you guys who are talking like this? Tell me, who are you two? And that allows for Virgil to identify himself, okay? And it becomes one of the first of the many surprises that we see. And surprises turn out in Purgatory to be a really good thing. Surprise is good because you always get more than you bargain for. Purgatory is, in fact, a place where one gets more than one bargains for. So here it is. Virgil announces himself. Before those souls worthy to climb to God were taken to this mountain by his grace, my bones were buried by Octavian. I am Virgil. The reason I lost heaven was through no other fault than lack of faith. And so, you know, there's Sordello, and he says, this can't be happening. This is just simply too good to be true. And then he tries another kind of embrace, this time based on the fact that it turns out that Sordello himself is a poet, and he wants to do homage to the person that he sees as the greatest of all poets, and certainly the greatest of all poets to come from Mantua. So they embrace on a very different basis. O glory of the Latin race, he said, you who did prove the power of our tongue, O deathless excellence of my own land. And what's kind of nifty about all of that is that it shows the first example of poetry and politics beginning to mix together a little bit, beginning to come together, beginning to show that they have something in common, which was, of course, another one of those things that was separated back in Inferno 10, where we had a little discussion of politics, a little discussion of poetry, a discussion of politics again, and they never met. They never came together. So here you have, finally, for the first time, poetry and politics meeting in a rather cordial way. And that, too, becomes a kind of prediction for what else we're going to see in the Purgatory.
At the end of Canto 7, where this embrace takes place that Ram was just discussing, Dante and Virgil run into a whole bunch of kings, negligent rulers, people who, when they were alive and ruling in the various monarchies of Europe, didn't do very well. This is not just an Italian problem. It is a worldwide problem. But Dante uses this episode to come back to an issue that he's already introduced that Ron mentioned a few minutes ago. Because what these kings do is talk about their heirs who are currently ruling in various parts of Europe. And he says, not often does the sap of virtue rise to all the branches. This is his own gift, and we can only beg that he bestow it. So that, once again, Dante is going to have to learn some things about the nature of family. Because the fact that your daddy's a king, a bad king or a good king, doesn't predict what you're going to be. Things don't work that way. And certainly, Dante suggests, you don't tend to get generation after generation after generation of gifted kings. Well, kings may simply be a dramatic way of talking about families in general. It not only happens among royal families, it happens among all families. And again, to go back to Inferno 10, there was such a pride of ancestry that Farinata displayed. And of course, the first thing you wanted to know from Dante was, who would your ancestors be? Well, we've got to learn, Dante's got to learn about family. What is it about our ancestors that we can take pride in? How can we use that pride? What if we have ancestors who are not such good guys? What does that say about us and the nature of family?
Just a couple more things before we sort of move to the very gate of purgatory. One is that Sordello hangs around for a while. That is to say, as Dante and Virgil continue their journey, so also does Sordello with them. Again, quite a departure from anything that we saw in Hell. Other thing is that the last category, again, as Bill intimated, that we see before we get to the gate are rulers who are there for having been negligent of their own spiritual development. It seems like the deal is that they were so eager for worldly glory that they have neglected things connected with their soul. So they are sort of a kind of last category by themselves before we get to the actual steps and gate leading up there. And it becomes a kind of nifty way of also saying this is the final way in which people there have made God wait. And the consequence is that, of course, they have to wait themselves before they get to go through the gate of purgatory.
One of the most dramatic events in the entire Commedia is, in fact, in Purgatory 9, where Dante and Virgil actually pass through the gate of Purgatory proper. And that's where we're going to begin next time.
Lecture 14, The Sin of Pride.
In Purgatory 9, Dante and Virgil arrive at the actual gate of Purgatory, one of the most dramatic events in the entire Commedia. There's an angel there, and in order to get to the gate itself, Dante must go up three steps, which are described as being of three different colors, white, green, and red. Traditionally, they stand for the three theological virtues. White is the sort of purity of faith. Green is the color of hope. And red represents the fire of love. So that as we approach the gate of heaven, we approach through these three theological virtues that ultimately come from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. The angel there has St. Peter's keys and represents St. Peter. Peter isn't here. We're going to meet Peter later on when we get to paradise. And there are a number of ritual acts that take place as Dante prepares to pass through the gate. One of them, very interestingly, is that Dante has seven letter P's carved on his forehead, standing for peccata in Latin, or sin. And therefore, as Dante climbs the seven-story mountain, one of those P's will be erased, and therefore he will be lighter and his climb will be easier. And as Dante actually passes through the gate, there is this great chorus of music in a hymn called the Te Deum. And it's interesting to note what this sounds like. And as the grazing pivots rolled, I turned, for I heard chanting Te Deum Laudamus, accompanied by the sweet notes of that door. The harmony of sounds made me recall just how it seems in church when we attend to people singing as the organ plays. It takes us back once again to this notion of the importance of ritual that Dante likens going through the gate of heaven to being at a particular part of the Mass, of the church service. And therefore, as Dante completes this journey through the gate, he arrives on the Terrace of Pride, where we have purgation per se beginning.
Well, let's talk about pride for just a minute. It's the worst, the chief of the so-called seven deadly sins. And I think there's an immediate problem for a modern audience because we tend to use the word with positive connotations. If somebody says you ought to take pride in good work, or you ought to take pride in the fact that You did very well in school. This is a fine thing. The difficulty is that that same word meant something very different to Dante. And maybe the best way of getting at it is simply remind ourselves of what we said over and over again, really, when we were talking about the nature of sin and the sinners that we saw in the Inferno. That in the Inferno, in various ways, people essentially made themselves the center of the universe. Well, that's pride taken to its ultimate extreme. And so if you are looking for a definition of pride that would help us to see what Dante is getting at, to see why this is the first sin, the first tendency towards sin that needs to be purged, what I think you need to think about is pride is that tendency in all of us to make of ourselves something more than we are. Okay? It's very important that we see who we are, that we accept that, that we acknowledge that, and quote-unquote take pride in the modern sense in that way. Right? But what Dante is dealing with here is something very different. And we get into a lot of trouble if we don't realize that he's talking about something very, very different. These are folks who have this tendency to put themselves at the center of the universe. And because of that, that's the first thing that has to be treated. That's the first thing that has to be dealt with. And it turns out that there's a really wonderful way of dealing with it.
When Dante and Virgil arrive, they see the inner wall of the mountain carved with extraordinarily realistic sculpture. It's interesting that Dante spends a lot of time describing three sculpted panels that, of course, are slightly curving because the mountain itself curves. And Dante is, at least in large part, describing a kind of sculpture that had developed recently in Italy, a style that went back to looking at some ancient Roman sculpture and that we use particularly in a series of pulpits that were carved in Pisa and Siena and Pistoia. Very realistic, very three-dimensional. In fact, some of the figures of this sculpture are almost freestanding in these pulpits. And so Dante is using a kind of modern artistic style that's just beginning to develop in Italy as a way to illustrate three stories that he wants us to know. These are stories about humility, stories about the virtue that is the opposite of the sin of pride.
So notice what's going on here. Two things to pay close attention to. One, the way to deal with this, the way to kind of reform the will, is to look at really good art. And two, the really good art is going to contain the opposite virtue to the vice that is being purged here. We learn by seeing if we are capable of seeing. And so to make it easier for us, what happens is that we get examples of the most realistic art that we can. What we have are these magnificent examples, better than anything that any earthly artist could do, because, of course, the person who did the sculpting is God himself. And what we do is watch Dante and Virgil and the pilgrims as they observe what's there. And Dante the poet actually describes what's on the wall with these three very interesting and important examples. Before we actually look at the text, which is really quite wonderful, as Bill said, there are three of them. And it's interesting to see that they come from the New Testament, the Old Testament, and classical antiquity. That, in other words, there are stories that you can learn from in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, and also among the ancients, among the ancient pagans. And what Dante, the poet, is suggesting is that this becomes a kind of model for the purgation of the other sins as well, where you have the same kinds of examples coming from classical antiquity and the Bible together. He wasn't at all afraid to mix and match here.
One of the stories that we see here is especially important, and that's the story of the Annunciation, when the angel Gabriel comes to Mary and says, you're going to bear the Messiah. It's important for a couple reasons. First of all, in every one of the seven terraces, there will be a Marian example, an example from the life of the Virgin Mary. She personifies, if you will, all of the virtues. And the Annunciation is a good one to think about with regard to this, because especially as is told in Luke's gospel. The angel comes and says, Mary, you've been chosen to bear the Messiah. And it seems to me the easy thing for Mary to have done in a sense was say, wow, I must be pretty cool. That is to say, to take certain pride in the fact that I've been picked. But Mary responds with humility. Mary responds by giving all the glory to God and talks about her own lowliness. And therefore, this story becomes the first example of humility that Dante and Virgil see, and which, of course, the various souls in this part of purgatory see as they circle around this terrace of the mountain.
Now, it's interesting to see the way in which the description of this scene is given. The angel who came down to announce on earth the peace longed for by weeping centuries, which broke the ancient ban and opened heaven, appeared before our eyes, a shape alive, carved in an attitude of marble grace, an effigy that could have spoken words. One would have sworn that he was saying Ave, the first words, of course, that the angel speaks to Mary, hail, full of grace. And what the description tells us is that even though the angel wasn't speaking, it seemed as though he was. In other words, the realism was so exact, so precise, that one sense alone is not enough, that you have to talk about this not only in terms of sight, but in terms of sound. Now, this is a kind of paradox, of course, because you really can't get that exact when you're dealing with earthly sculpture. But of course, the point is that this goes beyond this. This takes realism to a new level. And so therefore, in describing it, the senses are all mixed. But it's kind of interesting that in examples of this from the art of Dante's time, those words, Ave, were actually carved coming out of the mouth of the angel and the voice sort of headed toward Mary, so that artists used sort of a different medium to sort of, you know, attach itself onto the simple painting. And what Dante is saying is that here, in God's version, the same thing is sort of being done, but without the necessity of really writing it in, because the gestures themselves are so lifelike. So what it does is sort of provide us with this spectacular super example, the implication of which is that this is what earthly artists are striving to do, all right, but are unable to. Now, notice what it also says. It says that realism is there not simply for its own sake, but because that's the best way of getting to see what the story is all about. People are going to learn from this very realistic kind of art, and God is the best example in these sculptures that he has done in the side of the mountain.
In the second story, we have an Old Testament image. It's a story from the life of King David. And Dante does more or less the same thing, suggesting a kind of mixed sensual experience, because in this particular scene from David, there is a censer with incense. With equal art, the smoke which censers poured was traced so faithfully that eyes and nose could not decide between a yes or no. Similarly, the sight of the sense of smell here works like the sense of sound in that first sculpture. But David's a very important person to have illustrate the virtue of humility for a couple reasons. First of all, he was a very talented guy. Secondly, he was both a political leader and a poet. After all, David is associated with 150 Psalms. And therefore, here is somebody that Dante can identify with. To use the term we've been using, David is a poet, awfully good one, and a politician, awfully good one. And here's an example of humility from a person who has so many talents. And what Rob was talking about earlier with regard to pride really comes home to roost here, it seems to me. That Dante, on the one hand, has to accept and use and recognize the talents he has without committing the sin of pride. He's got a lot, in some sense of the word, to be proud of. He's an accomplished poet. At one point in his life, he's an accomplished political figure as well. So David serves as a particularly good model for Dante, the poet and the politician who's here illustrating the virtue of humility.
And the third example, the one from classical antiquity, is also about someone sort of recognizing that there are, I mean, in David's case, what he's doing is, of course, this great moment of triumph, recognizing the necessity of giving praise to God, right? Not taking the credit for himself. In the classical example, the Emperor Trajan essentially accedes to the request of a poor widow. This sense, in other words, of humbling himself to pay attention to her request, even though it goes against, the way he had sort of filled in his calendar. Helping old widow was not part of what was going on that day. He changes his mind at her request. So you have three examples, all of which speak to the nature of humility, all of which are seen as a kind of antidote to pride. And then we're told at the end, okay, that one, for whom no new thing can exist, God obviously, fashioned this art of visible speech. Well, that's a very nifty way of talking about what all of these sculptures are. Ultimately, they are a kind of visible speech. Well, if you think about it, you sort of step back and say, what might this remind us of? Clearly, it relates to another kind of visible speech as well, right? That of the Commedia, that of the very poem that we're reading. And all of a sudden, we begin to see that what's happening within the poem, with Dante the pilgrim and Virgil looking at these sculptural programs there, what's going on in the poem is a kind of image for what the poem itself ultimately is going to have to try to do. That is to say, this is a poem that is intended to bring about moral improvement in the reader. And of course, the way that you do it is by making it as realistic as possible so that it can do the job, which is, of course, what Dante the poet is trying to do. And so here what we see is that Dante the pilgrim, looking at this sculpture, is learning a lesson which Dante the poet is going to have to put into place when he, in the fiction of the poem, constructs the poem, which is the reporting of what he has seen later on. So the lesson here is for all of the sinners who are in need of purgation of the sin of pride, but it's also a particular lesson for Dante the pilgrim. And again, that piggybacks so nicely on what Bill said about Dante as somebody who has to recognize the greatness of his own talents. The larger question is, to what end or purpose do I put those talents? And this is one of those key places in the poem where we're forced to think about and meditate about that particular issue.
Dante looks around and at first doesn't see any souls, anyone being purged of this sin, and has to have things explained to him. As it turns out, the reason he doesn't immediately see them is because they're all very badly bent over, because they all have great big rocks on their back, and therefore they're bent over with these rocks burying them down, sort of keeping them pushed very close to the ground and looking at the floor of the terrace where they are walking. It's, of course, a wonderful antidote to pride. If you think of Farinata down in hell, you know, with his chest puffed out and whatever, sort of looking up and out and disdaining all of hell, these are the folks who are all bent over, who can only look at the ground. It's also interesting that what they're carrying in their back is the rough stuff out of which sculpture is hewn. And therefore, it's another very clever way Dante reminds us that what we need to do is to become, in a sense, works of art. We need to allow God to sculpt us, if you will. So that, I think, reinforces what we see at this particular place.
Yeah, in fact, notice that the very description kind of contributes to the notion that the souls are in fact being described as though they were works of art. All right. Sometimes one sees a corbel holding the weight of roof or ceiling carved in human shape with chest pressed tightly down against his knees so that this unreality gives real anguish to one who sees it. This is how these souls appeared and how they made me feel. In other words, Dante is looking at this as though he were looking at a work of art. Again, as Bill said, that's because they are being sculpted, if you will, by the hand of God. But previously, we had seen all of these works of art, the most distinguishing characteristic of which was how lifelike they were. Art described as life, life described as art. And the two parts of the canto kind of interpenetrate that way and suggest that moral improvement has an awful lot to do with the function of art, both in terms of what the souls are being taught to do here and all of the rituals that we've been talking about that kind of that kind of summarize what goes on in Purgatorio, that you can look at all of these rituals as another kind of art shaping the souls, okay, with God as the artist for them all.
This image of the corbel really is a lovely one, because in many churches, on near the roofs, also holding up things like pulpits, for example, there'd be little scrunched over folks who have a column in their back who are holding up the roof. They're very common pieces of medieval decorative sculpture in churches. And it's to that, the corbel, that Dante likens these souls. As we move to Canto 11, Dante begins a series of conversations with souls who are there in the Terrace of Pride. And interestingly enough, we could divide this canto into three conversations. The first, about politics. Dante meets a political figure named Umberto. The second, about art, both poetry and the visual arts. And the third, about politics, a pattern that Dante used in Inferno 10 with Farinata, Cavalcante, Farinata. Same pattern, very different reality. Umberto is a very interesting guy to start with, because in many ways, he sort of did what Farinata did. He was a Ghibelline living in Ghibelline territory in Siena. But he was so angry with the government of Siena, even though it was his own party, that he switched sides and became a Guelph. That's Dante's party, by the way. But Umberto is in purgatory, which of course means Umberto will be in heaven, because, again, Umberto repented. And it's a very interesting story he also tells, because what he understands is, not only did I hurt myself while I was acting in that way, I hurt my territory and I hurt my family. And that he is repentant, and he fully realizes that what he was doing on earth at one time that was just about him wasn't just about him. It was about the territory he ruled south of Siena, and it was about his family, which, as he describes now, is more or less in ruin in Dante's own day.
And it's wonderful. If you take a look at the text, Bill made the connection here between the folks that we see here in Farinata. If you take a look at what he says about himself, I was Italian, born of a great Tuscan. Guglielmo Aldobrandesco was my sire. Well, remember old Farinata there with self, with party, with family. And remember also that he was the one who stopped Dante by saying, "Oh, Tuscan, I see by your accent that you're one of us." And then, of course, uses that to make all of these distinctions. The next line that this guy makes, "Perhaps you never heard the name before." In other words, unlike Farinata, who assumes everybody knows who he is, he doesn't have that same kind of pride anymore at all, and is willing to believe that he has to fill in some of the details for Dante. Again, this wonderful, wonderful difference between the two of them. One other thing, of course, we had already mentioned previously that by the time we get to Purgatory, we're going to see a lot of people who are from the rival city to Florence, from Siena. It's interesting how many of them find their way into Purgatorio, and it's interesting to see how many of them find their way into Purgatory here in this particular canto.
In fact, the second political figure we meet is also Sienese. He was, in fact, the victor at the Battle of Monteperti, along with Farinata. But there are a number of reasons why Dante might have a lot of Sienese here. Dante does, both in Hell and in Purgatory, sort of make a little bit of fun of the Sienese for their silliness, for a kind of pretension they have, you know, that we can be as great or as big as Florence, because Siena was a much smaller place. But I think also, as Dante looked at Siena in its own day, in Dante's own day, that is to say the generation after the Battle of Monteperti, what he saw was a well-governed city. He saw a city in which factionalism had been radically reduced. He saw stability. The same government ruled Siena in the same form from 1287 to 1355, long after Dante had died. He saw a city that had been every bit as involved in factionalism as Florence was, that wasn't in Dante's day. Florence doesn't have to be like that. That it is possible for a city to reform, to change, to get its act together, to focus on unity, to focus on what unites rather than what divides.
Notice, of course, what a wonderful act of humility it is on the part of Dante, the poet, to admit that and to put it in his poem. This is perhaps the best proof that we have that what we see about Dante in Inferno is by no means the final picture, that that's exactly what he has to purge himself of. In this ultimate kind of partisanship between Florence and Siena, he's using Siena as a kind of model here in a way that I think he would have died rather than to do as we see him in 1300 as the pilgrim on this journey.
We move from this first discussion of politics to a discussion of art, first with manuscript illumination. Dante recognizes a manuscript illuminator, a painter of those beautiful letters and designs in manuscripts, says, you know, you must be Odorici, honor of Gubbio, honor of the art, which men in Paris call illuminating. Listen to how Odorici responds, one of the great manuscript illuminators. The pages of Franco Bolognese paints, he says, my brother, smile more radiantly. His is the honor now, mine is far less.